Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 2nd of Av. If you're listening to this, you probably already know that after the first year series completed, which was 5 days a week, I am filling in the missing dates. So you should be able to, over the course of this coming year, fill out all the days of the year with all 7 days a week, God willing, with tshuvot written on that Hebrew date, except for the dates when it's impossible to have a tshuva. Today we're going to see, for the 2nd of Av, we're going to see a Shuva in the Chatam Sofer, in the first volume of Chatam Sofer, the Or Chaim section, responsive number 12, and it's from the 2nd of Menachem Av of Tuf Kuf Pei of 1820, and it's written to a Rav Tzvi Avigdor, who was the Rav of Munkach. Now, interestingly, in Munkach, at the time, there wasn't yet a Hasidic Rebbe. This is the last, as far as I can tell from Wikipedia, this is the last non-Hasidic Rebbe of Munkach. He's followed by Rav Tzvi, and he passes away 4 years after this tshuva. He passed away in 1824, and then Rav Tzvi Elimelech Shapira of Dinov, I think, becomes the Rebbe, and whatever goes on from there. So Munkach becomes a very well-known name in Hasidus, but there's no Hasidic overtones to this discussion at all. So he sends to the Chatam Sofer a question about a different place, which had sent him a question about succession in the rabbinate. Now, when Chatam Sofer starts his tshuva, he says, you know, I'm not in my usual place. Av, second of Av, is always in the summer. And he says, when I leave town in the summer, and I go to this other place to get the good air, right, the fresher air or the cooler air. So I go to this other place. I don't have all my svarim with me. But I'm going to answer your question to the best that I can, because it's an important question to talk about. In a certain town, not Munkach, there was a rabbi who wanted to install his son in his place. Now, the son is ra'oi l'oto, he's worthy of being the rabbi of the town, but some rich man in the town doesn't want him to be, and they're coming and they're having a fight about it, and it's gotten political, and it's gotten problematic. And so this rav from Munkach wants to try to sort of step in and help them out. He's close to the town. He knows the town is having problems, communal problems, right? Once you have a community fight, it affects the whole community. And so he wants to step in and help out. It's an interesting question to me, and it comes up to our times as well, as to when people should or shouldn't step in and when they're responsible to should have stepped in. I was recently somewhere, and somebody was talking about some political problem in the Jewish community today and said, such group should step in and impose a solution. And I thought to myself, I said out loud also, that it's sort of unfair because the people involved in the commotion who have the power and the ability to make it all go away and all be better aren't doing so. So how come you transfer the responsibility to this other group? So here, this rough from Munkach is taking it upon himself. We'll see the Chatam Sofer's reaction to that in a minute. But he's taking it upon himself to try to help them out. So he says that in his letter, he says that the people in that community had agreed that whatever the Chatam Sofer decides is what they're going to accept. In other words, he had stepped in. He didn't say, I know well enough what you should be doing, you should listen to me. He said, let's refer the matter to an expert. Chatam Sofer is our expert. And they, he claims, agreed. Now, when the Munkacher Rav sent this letter to the Chatam Sofer, the Chatam Sofer says, and you hinted to me in the letter that you think it's very clear that there is succession. Because it's a Gemara in Ketubot, and the Rambam says, is what the letter claimed, that people inherit positions in halacha. This is a position, he's worthy of the position, he should inherit. So, that's the question. Now, the Chatam Sofer starts in a way that I was also just recently writing up one of the tshuvah, another tshuvah for a different day, a day in Kislev, I forget which day, but then the Netziv also asks a question on a different issue, but he starts off in a similar vein to how the Chatam Sofer starts off. Chatam Sofer says, I really shouldn't have answered you at all until I knew what the other people think, meaning the guy who's writing it to him says, here's what I think is very clear, but there's another side, right? What's the rich man who opposes installing the son of the Rav? What's he claiming? So depending on what he's claiming, that could be a relevant question, because let's say he has a real claim. And says the Chatam Sofer, and you need to know, I can't know how to judge a dispute until I hear both sides, because maybe the other man has a claim that's actually a valid claim, right? That's always the problem in arguments. If I hear one side's argument, if they're at all smart, they've phrased it in a way because they've convinced themselves, and I'm not saying they've done it maliciously, they've convinced themselves that they're absolutely right. So if they convince themselves they're absolutely right, they think they're right, and that must mean that they have a logic that to them seems airtight. Now, when they present that logic to somebody else, that somebody else might also think it's airtight. It sounds airtight. Why wouldn't it be airtight? Except that if we brought now, sometimes we'll bring in the other party, and the other party will just say stupid things, right? And they'll just say things that are irrelevant. We'll say, no, the halacha is like the first side. But sometimes we bring them in, and they make a point, and we had never thought of that point, and that point really says, no, maybe the halacha is like their side. So the Chazon Sofer says, I really shouldn't be answering you. I should have written you a letter back that said, I can't answer until I hear from both sides. Besides what she says, this is another important point about this issue, I wasn't asked this question from the people involved in the dispute. I'm getting a letter from you, right? And you're not the rub of that place. They're from a different place. It's very clear you're left from a different place. And you're saying that they want to hear from me. But it looks like, he says, it looks like we're getting involved. You are getting involved. There's a. I think, I could be wrong, but I think there's a rebuke underlying here, a gentle rebuke, but a rebuke that you're getting involved in the issue that's not your issue. So if you went to them and you said, I think that you're having problems and why don't you go to the Chatam Sofer, and they turn to the Chatam Sofer, that would be very good. You would have done a service for that community, but that's not what's going on here. Not only that, he says, if it's true, as you claim in your letter, that the leaders of that community want to send me a question, we have a practice, we have interaction with those people often. What they do is they go to the noblemen of their community, and the noblemen or their area, I think he means the non-Jewish noblemen, but I'm not sure, and the non-Jewish noblemen, meaning because they have to say, I think it's there was an international relations issue here, right? They didn't want, if the Chatam Sofer is living someplace else other than they, in a different country, they don't want the justice, the courts of this other country necessarily being seen as the ruling law for their country. So the way you would handle it, if you have a situation where you needed to consult the Chatam Sofer on an issue, was you would go to the noble people, the nobility of your country, and you say that we have a problem, and there's a great rabbi we have to consult. They would contact the nobility of Hungary, I suppose, where in Pressburg, where the Chatam Sofer was, and then he would answer the question. And he's happy to do that, he says, but he hasn't gotten that, so therefore, theoretically, he shouldn't have answered at all. But since he contacted me, he says, Lo emna tov zit Torah. I'm not going to withhold something good, which is Torah. Now, that Tov Shetorah is because there's drushes in the Mishnah, the Gemara, that say, when you see a pasuk that refers to Tov, it means Torah. It implies one of the things that it can mean is Torah. So I'm not going to deny you something good, Torah. So I'm going to share with you my understandings of these halachic issues without, meaning, he's being very clear, say without it meaning necessarily that this is halacha for that place. So you can't apply it to that place. You hear the claims of both sides. Let's talk a little about inheriting positions in halacha. So the Rambam in the first chapter, Hilchos Melachim, Halacha Zayin, says, Sham Melachim, kings, v'chol minuye Yisrael, and all Jewish appointments, b'Yerusha me'avot livnehem, are always, he says, passed down b'Yerusha. Now, Yerusha sounds like an inheritance. We're going to come back to that question of how inheritance works. I'll say this is an important, this is not in the Chatam Sofer Teshuva, it's taken for granted, but it's important, it's a needed underlying idea of the tshuva, which is that inheritance in halacha happens automatically. It's not in halacha, it's not that when sadly somebody passes away, that whoever the heirs are, let's assume for now that there are three sons, and these three sons are the heirs, it's not that the heirs come now to their father's possession and take hold of it. As soon, the moment the father passes away, the property becomes the property of the heirs. What has to happen later is that the heirs have to divide it and decide which of that property will go to each of them. But the process of inheritance happens automatically. So when we say here, the words that when the Rambam says that it goes b'Yerusha me'avot l'benahim, you might have thought that that meant that the moment that the father passes away, the son, the heir, becomes that position, right? The rav of a town, the butcher, the cousin, that if sadly the old man, as it were, passes away, the next one. So he got that, the Rambam, from a pasuk, from a Gemara in Ketubot, and Daf Kuf Gimel Amud Bet, the Chatam Sofer tells us, V'yolif la mikra, and they learn it from a verse. So the verse in Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 23, V'amamlacha, Natan li horam ki hu abechor. That when it comes to, sorry, it's in Devarim Bet, but it's Perek Chaf Aleph Pasuk Gimel, and it's talking about Yehoshaphat. After Yehoshaphat passes away, who becomes king? Yehoram becomes king. But the way the Pasuk reads in Pasuk Bet and Gimel is, V'lo Achim b'nei Yehoshaphat. He has other brothers who are sons of Yehoshaphat. Azariah, Yechiel, Zechariah, Azariah, Michael, and Shvatya. And it says that her father gave them lots of gifts and a lot of gold and silver and gold and good food and even cities to control. But then it says that Amlachan Atan Yoram Ki Abachor. But he gave the kingship to Yoram because he was the firstborn. So from there, the Gemara in Ketubot gets the idea that Yerusha, that the even positions passing kingship to the Bechor, to the firstborn, to whoever it is, and it's a function of Yerusha of inheritance. The problem is, says the Chatam Sofer, you have another Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Bet Amid Bet, where they say there, in terms of Jewish kings, kings of Israel, that we appoint them in Nisan. It's a question there, because one of the Rosh Hashanahs, one of the New Years, is the New Year's for king, and we say it's in Nisan. They say, what do you mean it's Nisan? How does it work? That discussion was not our discussion today, but they say along the way, that if the group that was appointing the king, as it were, gets together in Adar and picks him, and we're talking about, the Gemara says, we're talking about a Melech ben Melech, somebody who is the son of a king, so it sounds like, even though he's the son of the king, we need to have a group get together and decide that, yes, he'll be the king, and that it doesn't fully take effect until he becomes the king in Nisan. So if Yimalchut is Yerusha, if kingship is inheritance, then as soon as the father passes away, this is where that introduction comes up. As soon as the father passes away, then it's it. He's king. Right? That's what we said is true and is true about property. So why is it different when it comes to Yerusha of positions, to inheritance of positions? So he says, Chazal Sofer says, I think the answer is that it's not really a full inheritance like with non-Jewish kings. Non-Jewish kings, you say, the king is dead, along with the king, what you mean is, as soon as the king is dead, the next guy in succession, right? You have a whole line of succession, you have it well established, the next guy in the line of succession is the guy. And it's already the king, right? You know, she should live and be well. But when Queen Elizabeth dies, Prince Charles becomes the king right away in England. Unless he decides he doesn't want to. And has he already opted out of it? By marrying Camilla? I don't even remember. Could be. So if that's true, then William would become the king. But it's automatic, is the point. So, and it doesn't matter, and his personal qualifications don't matter. He could be wise, he could be stupid, whatever it is, but he becomes the king. Whereas in the Jewish people, and this is where the contrast is important, and why even though we use the word Yerusha, it's not exactly accurate, Nachala is not his automatically. It's a Kisei Yagdil. By taking the throne, that's when he becomes king. But the answer is, the way we understand it is, that we have a qualification question plus a Yerusha question plus an inheritance question. If the son, or there is a son, if there is a child of the deceased, who, and usually it's men, because these positions are usually the kinds of positions that halacha assumes women are not supposed to hold. That's a different discussion, not our discussion at all today. But I want you to be sure that I not to think that I didn't notice that I'm using male pronouns. I'm using them because, by and large, it's men that we're talking about here. So if the son, if a son or the son, is m'malei makom avotav. Now, m'malei makom avotav literally means fills his father's position, but it doesn't mean exactly fills it or completely fills it, because then we would say he's clearly the best guy because he's just like the father. What we mean is competent to fill it. Will do as far as we can tell, has the ability to do a reasonable job. In that situation, the son will inherit the position, even if there are others, da'adifa mine, who are better for the job than that person. So that's an interesting qualification. You know, in kings, it's hard to remember because we haven't had kings in the Jewish people in a long time. But chazan is another position where this issue can come up. We're going to talk about it more in the course of the tshuva. But let's see, you have a guy who's a chazan. He's been the chazan for 50 years, and he's the one, everybody loves him, and he's a wonderful chazan. And he passes away. And his son is a good chazan, meaning anybody who would come into the shul and hear the son daven would say, yeah, that's a good chazan, it's a fine chazan, it's a competent chazan, everything's right, there's nothing wrong with his chazan. But you know what? There's the world-class chazan who's decided he would like this shul as well. And this could easily happen, especially if, for example, the father had been a world-class chazan, and the son is a perfectly good guy and a good chazan, but nothing like what his father was, but the person who is now like what his father was wants the job. The answer is, in halacha, if as long as the son meets, now I'm going to say minimal standards, I don't mean minimal standards like he's really a bad cousin, we just don't want to say he's a bad cousin. I mean, he's a good, right, competent, means perfectly competent for the job. It doesn't mean we're gonna overlook things for the sake of getting him in. It means perfectly competent for the job, just may not be outstanding in that way. So then we'll give that person the job, even if somebody else is not standing out there. But if he's not, if it's not somebody who can competently fill his father's shoes, as it were, then other people have the right to get the job. And that would be why, even if we're talking about a melech ben melech, where there's an inheritance element to it, you might have thought the king, the son of a king who's about to become king, is an inheritance issue. Now, you could have answered something else. You could have said, well, but what if he has brothers, and you're picking him from among the brothers? But whatever the answer to that question is, he says, you need a minoi. That's how you know you need a minoi. You need the people to get together and say, and evaluate, whether he's mimale makom avotah, whether he, in fact, can fill his father's shoes. But if we determine that he can, then it's not like there's a completely new king here. I mean, that's why the terminology of Yerusha, of inheritance, is appropriate. First, because, as we just said, there's a way in which it really is an inheritance. An inheritance in the fact that this person has priority for the position, even though he's only competent, you know, he's only a B-plus chazen, whereas there's an A-plus chazen out there who wants the job. So that's the Yerusha element to it. That's the element by which he inherits it, and therefore it is considered and appropriately referred to as a Yerusha. And then he says, and I discussed this actually in my commentary, in my Gilyon HaShas, my notes on my volume of Shas in Sota. So this Gilyon HaShas, let's remember that the Chatam Sofer, even though he's a year and a half younger than Rabbi Akiva Eiger, only a year and a half younger than Rabbi Akiva Eiger, actually became his son-in-law when he was in his 50s. His first wife passed away, and I think they hadn't had any children. And then Rabbi Akiva Eiger's daughter's husband passed away, and she had, so I think she already had a child, or maybe she didn't have a child, but they got married and had many, many children together. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger has a Gilyon HaShas. Now we find out that Chatam Sofer has a Gilyon HaShas also, which is not printed in the Vilna Shas, but the idea that you have a Gilyon HaShas is just that when you're learning Torah, you write notes on the side, and maybe when you originally wrote them, you thought they would just be for you, but then as you became somebody, as Rabbi Akiva Eiger, for example, became somebody the whole Jewish world recognizes as an important Torah scholar, they included them in the Gemara, but not the Chasam Sofer. So Chasam Sofer is in my Gilyon HaShas. If you look up my copy of Sotam, Imam Aleph Amid Beit, there's a discussion there about Rechavam, the son of Shlomo. After Shlomo passes away, and the Tanakh tells us that Hashem wanted to split the kingdom to punish Shlomo for whatever he wanted to punish Shlomo for, not our topic today at all, we don't have to get into it, but Rechavam is the son who takes over. The Be'er Sheva, an important Achron on Gemara, had said, how could Rechavam have been put into the position of kingship to begin with, right? It's one thing that you're going to tell me that Hashem wants to split the kingdom and therefore he's going to do it through the next king, but the next king is a problem because his mother was Naama Ha'amonit. His mother was a convert. So the truth is, at the time, it still wasn't completely clear to people that he was allowed to marry her at all. But let's assume, as we do halakhically assume, that he's allowed to marry her as long as she converted sincerely, right? So she converts, they get married. And that's actually a question that Chatam Sofer doesn't deal with here, but there is a Gemara somewhere that says that they didn't accept converts in the times of David and Shlomo. So you have to say this was before it was the time of David, therefore you could still accept converts. So there isn't any more specific time on this, but the Gemara in Yevamos, a Gemara that asked that question about how Shlomo married Paro's daughter, and says Shlomo converted her, and says, we didn't accept Gerim. So it says, yeah, you didn't accept Gerim who had stood to benefit from the Gerut, like they'll eat fancier meals, they'll be in a richer environment, but she didn't have any of that, so Shlomo Melech felt comfortable converting her. So maybe you could say the same thing about Naama Hamonit. In any case, the question in our Chatam Sofer was that if Rechavam was the child of Naama Hamonit, then it makes him less worthy than other people because he is the child of converts, and converts is a whole issue because we generally assume that when it comes to kings, the pasuk says, "Mikerav achecha," from among your brothers, and the Gemara assumes it's supposed to be "Mimuvchar shebi achecha," from the best among your brothers. And if he's the child of a convert, so we today try to say the converts are just as good as the rest of us, and that's a whole discussion of its own, and I don't want to get into it. But the time of the Gemara, it was assumed there was at least in terms of, and there are, you know, nicer, as it were, more politically correct ways to say this, and less politically correct ways to say this, and I don't have a stake in either one. So however I say it, it's not because I mean anything in particular about that question, but at least in terms of being a part of the people, recognized as a part of the people, and therefore, since you're recognized as part of the people, being better able to serve as their king, because they'll sense you as their leader in all those ways, then the child of a convert is not quite as good because half of him, as it were, now once they convert, really, they're fully Jews, and that's true. But nonetheless, there are usually, and I don't mean to be political about our 300 times here either, so if you're taking it that way, you should not be, because I don't mean to say that, and how you apply it to any particular situation requires a lot of thought on its own, but that converts are not as full, are not yet so fully integrated into the people that he would be considered muvchar shebe'achecha, the best of the brothers to the best of Jews to put into that position. So how come he took that position? That's the Be'er Sheva said. So then Rav the Chatam Sofer says, "V'nirla ani yadaiti dafka tchilata sima." The whole idea of muvchar shebe'achecha, because basically the Chatam Sofer holds that kingship and other things are hereditary, and the definition of hereditary they gave was you don't need the best. So how, if I have a drasha that says you need the best, could he say that you don't need the best? His answer is that's in terms of picking the first guy to start out in a chain. That first guy. So in our case, that would be David HaMelech. In the time when you're picking David HaMelech, it has to be muvchar shebe'achecha. And if David HaMelech had been the child, the direct child of a convert, then maybe he wouldn't have been Melech, and that's the way he understands that issue. But once David became king, he was zoched to it. He took over it. Hu v'chol banav v'acharav. He and all his sons, descendants, and all the generations after them, as long as they're competent for the job, as long as they're proper, they probably fill the shoes of the job. And then he brings a couple of riyas from the couple of kids in the Gemara. There's a Gemara in Megillah, you go about, which says when they decree in heaven gedula for a certain person, greatness for a certain person, it's for him and all his generations until the end of times. But if he's magbias, well, if he acts arrogantly, then the Kodesh Baruch Hu finds a way to lower him and to teach him not to be so arrogant. So why do you need a Gemara to say this? Isn't this just the halacha that the children inherited? So v'yesh lamar sheposkim mishamayim sheyuchlu she's ku levanim emalim makom. When they say that they will decree that he gets gedula greatness for all his generations, it means the decree will be that the generations are proper and appropriate to it. So it doesn't contradict that. So that's the fundamental assumption of the Chatam Sofer about most communal positions, about like things like kingship is easy, president of a shul maybe, but kingship is easy, and that the definition is the person who's best for the job becomes the person, and then as long as that person has heirs who are worthy of the job, even if they're not the best for the job, they will have the right, by virtue of the Yerusha aspect element of it, the inheritance aspect or element of it, they will get the job even if there are better candidates out there. But if they're arrogant about it, then the Kodesh Baruch will punish them. They won't be competent to fill the job, and then somebody else will in fact take the job, and then that person's children will have the right to refuse it because they will have taken and gotten inheritance and whatever, and then it'll have switched in those ways. And that's part of the bracha that was given to David. When David was told that the kingship would stay in his family forever, part of the promise there was that he would always have children or sons, descendants, who were at least competent to do the job and therefore would have the right to take the job even in the face of others saying that they were better suited towards that job. So then he said, but I have a problem because I found a tshuva in the Rashba in tshuva Sof Siman Yud Shin. Sof Siman Shin, I think. In the Rashba, but the number of the Rashba is always very difficult because the way they number it, the way we number it, whatever. So if you're going to try to look up the Rashba, you should search the words. Let's say a father can no longer continue in his job. One of the easy places it comes up, and it comes up here in this tshuva, that's one of the examples he gives, is a chazan. Man, Nebuch gets old, his voice goes, and he's unable to do it. Whatever it is, it's not so simple to be a chazan. So he goes off, and he wants to have his son replace him. So the Rashba says, Shurat adin shehu kodem l'chol adam. The truth is, by law, that son has the prior rights to the position to anybody else. And then he says, because from what I can tell, it's a minhag that you appoint sons in, as long as the community agrees to it, you appoint sons in place of their fathers. So and he makes a klal gadol of it and all the appointments. So the question is, what does he mean that it's the custom? He says, I think it means that the Rashba that he was just reading says that from what I see, the custom is that sons get chosen in place of their fathers. So, what are you talking about custom? It's not a custom. It's the way it is. That's what we do. It's a Yerusha. Positions are, I want to say, are yarshind, but I'm pretty sure that's not English. Positions are inherited. So if they're inherited to the extent that we said before, why shouldn't that be true now? So why do you have to worry that it's a cool? Why do you have to call it a custom and say that we follow the custom? So another question, I haven't given you all of his questions, but another question the Rashba raises is then, why does the Rashba say, and he thinks this would be true even of a Kohen Gadol? Man's a Kohen Gadol, he's the high priest, and he passes away, and his son, or he's unable to fulfill his duties. So the Rashba had said, yes, so he would have his son, if his son was worthy of it, fill his place. So why do you have to say that as if it's like some big chiddush What's the big kiddush about a kohen girl? That should be true. And in fact, there's more yoba ayin bet amid bet, which also gives you a pasuk. It finds a verse for the idea that a kohen girl's son will fill in instead of him. So why is that? So the answer lies in a different source or a different attitude towards each of these ideas. So the Sifrei says, when it says "Bekerav of Kol Yisrael," it says "Some to Simel Achamel," talking about the king, says you have to make a king for yourself, and then that he'll rule "Bekerav of Kol Yisrael" and all the Jewish people. And then the Gemara says "Lerabot Kol Aminuyim." All the appointments in Halacha and in Judaism really are meant to be that kind of a model where you're picked and then you stay in that job forever, and your kid stays in that job, and it goes on that way. But the part of the problem with that is, therefore, that we're saying it applies to all minuyim, except as the Rambam wrote in Hilchos Melachim. But then we also say that a Mashuach Milchama is a Kohen who's appointed to be like the Kohen Gadol, going out when the Jews are going out to war, so he'll go with them. Because the real Kohen Gadol doesn't go out to war because he's too busy staying in and taking care of the Beit HaMikdash. But this guy, the Mashuach Milchama, can be appointed to go out to war. But that's a position that the Gemara says very clearly. He's not the child, the son, is not take over that position from the father, because the limud, the derivation that told us the same thing to the father when it comes to a kohen gadol was, I mean, so the counter pasuk is, Asher Yavo El Ohel Moed, that it's only those kohanim who go into Ohel Moed, the kohen gadolim, who go into Moed, whose position is hereditary, and the Rambam paskins that halacha as well. So it seems like that we said positions are hereditary, and now when it comes to a kohen gadol position, it seems like there's reason to think that it's not hereditary, and so the Mashuach Milchama is not hereditary. So why is that? Are these not appointments? And we said that when it comes to appointments of the Jewish people, they are for life and hereditary. So the Chatam Sofer says, it shows that when we talk about something being hereditary, we're talking about being a king, and things like being a king, that he clearly means that Pirchas Kohanim isn't like being a king. So the Chassid Sofer says, it's, I'm sorry, for a king, and for positions like a king. What are positions like a king? So there's Yerushalmi that says it, and Tosafot Sota cites that Yerushalmi, but it seems like Shotrei HaRabim, police officers, right, those who are in legal enforcement, Gabbai Tzedakah, those who collect money. Remember that most times in Jewish history, the Gabbai Tzedakah also assessed people for Tzedakah money. It wasn't only that they divvied it up, they assessed people for it, but Minuye Kedusha Inan Biklal. Those are political appointments of political power who have to get the community to move in a certain direction in their administrative way. But there are other positions that are called positions of Kedusha that have to do with the connection to sanctity of the person. And of course, the Kohen Gadol is that kind of person. That's why the Gemara insisted on finding an extra pasuk, a pasuk to tell us this idea that if a Kohen Gadol passes away or can't do his job anymore, that first in line is one of his sons. And that's all the more so for other Minuye Kedusha, for other appointments of sanctity. So now, let's get explained the Rashba, right? Because the Rashba is talking about a Chazan HaKnesi, talking about a Chazan. So he says, that's Tali B'min Haga. Why is it Tali B'min Haga? So he says, there are places that you treat a Chazan of the Shul a little bit like a Kohen Gadol. And if it's a little like a Kohen Gadol, then you'll say, well, just like a Kohen Gadol is a Yerusha with that special Pasuk, so are other things. But when it comes to, now we get to the Maharash Damsu, when it comes to things like the Rabbinate, like being the Rav, that's more like a position of Kedusha. And how do I know? Because you need a Pasuk for the Kohen Gadol in that situation, so the Rabbi's position of Kedusha, then it's not necessarily inherited. The Ramami Panu had a famous book called the Asara Ma'amarot. He said the same thing, that you don't bequeath a position as rabbi because it's the crown of Torah, and it's not. And what happened with Hillel at the time of the Mishnah, you have this chain. Says that was a political chain. That was the chain of who is the greatest Torah scholar. That's the political chain of running the nation. Because in Hillel's time, let's remember, the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, was also the person who was like the administrative leader of the Jewish people, and it wasn't the Torah part of it at all that was the issue. And it brings a proof, because in Horayot, in Yud Aleph Amid Bet, Rebbe, who was the man who put together the Mishnah, was the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, says to Rebbe Chiya, if I were to sin, what kind of a sacrifice would I sin? There's a sacrifice called the bull version is called the Parhel and Dovah Shel Tzibur. The whole community makes a mistake. They bring one bull or 13 bulls, depending on your count, but they bring bulls not for the whole, not every individual, but for the fact of the national sin. When it comes to the Nasi, to a king or a head of the people, so the head of the people would also bring a special korban. He's bringing a sa'ir, a goat instead of having everybody in the instead of having to bring the ordinary person's sheep for that situation of having done a chatas, having done a sin like that. So Rebbe says, what about me? Maybe I should have to bring one of those if I were in that situation. He says, nope, because there's a resh galuta in Bavel. There's an exilarch is the English word. I think it's originally a Latin word, but there's an exilarch in Bavel, and he's higher than you. So it shows that the idea that a nasi had power over the Jewish people, was the leader of the Jewish people, was a political idea, and that would be more clearly why it would be inherited. And that explains also, there's a Gemara that tells that when Rebbe was about to pass away, he sort of divvied up his kingdom, as it were. And he said, even though Shimon, my son, is a chacham, right, so that would be sound like he should be the one to take over the Sanhedrin, he says, Gamliel should be Nasi. My son Gamliel should be a Nasi. Why is that? Because Gamliel he was competent enough to be the head, but he was also, I think, better, or at least though he was the one who filled his father's shoes in Yirath Chet, in fear of heaven. So since the question here is who's going to get the inheritance of Torah, it's not the political inheritance, it's the inheritance of Torah, so Rebbe felt like he had to say it's the one who has the greater Yirath Chet, because that's the key component to the study of Torah, and you have that in Parshas Melech as well. You want to make sure the king doesn't stray from what Hashem wants. So, coming back to our case now, he says to these rabbis' cases, he says, if the community, the majority of the community, doesn't want him, so that would suggest, I think what the Chatam Sofer means to say is that would suggest he's not really a Mamalei Makom Avotav, it's not really somebody who fills his father's place even competently, and that's why the majority are voting against him, and therefore he can't force that. But if the community did agree, and the motives of the Chatam Sofer says aren't so important, he says even if they want to appease the existing realm, now I think there have to be limits to that too, because if he's completely incompetent, they're just currying favor with their old Rav, that's to me easily a problem. I actually know an example of a prominent Rav, so he didn't try to get a son in the position, but the son who got smicha at some point later became somebody who was not observant. So clearly that wouldn't be a mamalei makom avotav, even the majority of the community had, for whatever crazy reason, voted for that person, therefore that person could not take over the position. But as long as the son fulfills the position and can do so competently, he will get the job. And he says, we see other places where the job is not taken by the best person. So when Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua have a famous fight in the Gemara, and the Sanhedrin says Rabban Gamliel cannot be the leader for at least a while, he has to be suspended from his position, and they need to replace him. So Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yehoshua are around, and they're both recognized Torah scholars. But they picked instead, for various reasons, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and that's the famous story we know of his beard turning, having 18 streaks of gray or of white in it. So you see that the standard for the example of Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Akiva show that it's not always the people who are the absolute best for the job. There could be other factors come into play, and that can be true of Rabbanim as well. So when it comes to this town, therefore, it's not clearly true that just because the son is basically Malay Makam HaMatav that he necessarily gets it, because when it comes to positions like that, they're not purely political positions. So there are other factors that come into play, such as, for example, Yirat Shamayim and things like that. And that is the Chatam Sofer's sort of response to the question of whether a son should definitely get his father's position in the rabbinate from the second day of Menachem Av of Kuf Pei of 1820 from the Chatam Sofer to the Rav of Munkach. Have a great day.